Governor Sean Parnell, welcome to Sitka.
It's great to be here. It's and I'm not sure when this is going to broadcast, but this is a sunny day, and I'm loving it. This is beautiful.
What brings you to town?
You know, I am actually getting out to our southeast communities. I've had a chance to be in Ketchikan and Wrangell today in Sitka, then I'll be on to Petersburg. And I just so enjoy being able to speak with Alaskans, hearing from them. So I'm not only, you know, speaking in front of lunch forums, but just getting a chance to be out and about in our summer in southeast. It's great.
You were at the Chamber of Commerce this afternoon. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and you addressed in part, I know, the Choose Respect campaign. Have you seen Sitka's mural?
I have, but I've actually seen more of Sitka residents who are participating in the Choose Respect marches and been through the shelter. And I am just so proud of Sitkins, you know, for stepping forward in this epidemic time. Do you want to talk some more about the mural? But
I asked about the mural mostly because that's the most high profile part of the campaign here in town, or the most visible part of it.
But tell me where did it end up getting placed?
It's on the middle school.
Okay, All right. I haven't seen it hanging. I need to go do that.
Okay, so. Yeah, it's on the side of the middle school, and I guess I wonder, communities like Sitka, did you, when you launched the campaign, did you expect it to? It certainly has taken root here, and I know other communities are doing a lot for it.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I am so proud of Alaskans for this. You know, our Choose Respect initiative is really about ending the epidemic of domestic violence and sexual assault. It's about prevention, it's about enforcement, and it's about those support services. So it's trying to prevent it before it starts, but it's also about taking care of our victims and survivors after it's happened and getting some enforcement. So the Choose Respect rally itself is part of that prevention piece. And in 2010, when we had 18 communities, I thought that was great. And I was so amazed that 18 communities would step up. And then in 2011, when about 64 communities stepped up. And then this year, when 124 communities hosted Choose Respect rallies, Sandy and I, my wife, we actually participated this year in Fairbanks at noon, and then we flew to Huslia in the interior and participated with about 200 residents from Huslia out of 350 residents in that town. And so I did not really think that – I didn't even conceive that it could get to 124 communities, but I'm just so proud of Alaskans for doing this on behalf of their other Alaskans.
It certainly caught on in terms of visibility. Are you seeing a difference in – statistics or a difference in attitudes? What are you seeing?
Well, first off, we've given permission to people to speak about something that's been unspeakable and private, which shouldn't be. And when families get together, we get together with friends, it's kind of a topic that we've not wanted to broach because it's been uncomfortable, much like drunk driving was 40 years ago. It used to be that you go to a party 40 years ago, and if your friend got drunk, he would take the keys and go to the car and drive away. Well, now it's socially acceptable and okay. You take the keys from him, say, I'm going to drive you, and you go drive him. Similarly, with domestic violence and sexual assault, it's becoming more okay in Alaska now to address our friends and family members and say, I need to get you some help. Let me go get you some help. Or here's a number you can call where you can get shelter. These are things that we are now willing to talk about with each other. And secondly, every time a Choose Respect rally is held, these annual rallies are held, more victims and survivors get help. I heard from a Southwest village, Southwest Alaska community, where just the act of putting up a Choose Respect poster urging community members to turn out, one woman who was being beaten realized that people cared for her and that there was help available, and she called, made a plan, got the help she needed. And those are the kinds of stories that keep me going, because it is making a difference. And that's that prevention piece that I get excited about. So.
And the future of that campaign is to keep it going and perhaps expand it? Or?
Well, it's actually going to take a different turn now. And I'm excited to talk about this, because I kept setting higher and higher goals for our staff on the numbers of communities. But I said, look, we're at kind of a critical mass now across Alaska with 124 communities. And yes, we want more to participate. But there's another way that respect can become a cultural value for all Alaskans, another way. And that is through our young people and through the sporting events. There's a wonderful coach in Juneau named John Blasco who coaches at Thunder Mountain High School. He set about putting together, he adopted a curriculum called Coaching Boys to Men, and he adopted these character traits into his training of his basketball team. So Choose Respect became a pledge that his basketball team took. They wore Choose Respect t-shirts and warm-ups, and they became kind of Choose Respect models in the school. Pretty soon now, every Juneau high school and middle school has taken the Choose Respect pledge. It's gone to Hoonah as well. And what I see is the ability for coaches across Alaska to adopt curriculums with their teams where they not only teach a kid how to play a point guard, but they teach them how to respect each other as well. And if that can become a greater part of our culture, I think we'll be better people in the end.
Let's jump into some policy questions.
Oh,
some,
heck. I love the people side, too. But let's talk about how policy impacts people.
Yes. I want to begin with oil policy. And I know that there was tension between you and the Senate this year, especially Sitka Republican Bert Stedman. There were some words exchanged, at least not directly. But anyway, it was over oil policy. And assuming, of course, that everyone has the best interest of the state in mind, where does it go? Where does the conversation go from here and from this last session?
Well, I think we've made some progress in people actually now understand that we're at 585,000 barrels a day of throughput through TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, 585,000 barrels a day, and we once were 2.2 million. We're at 585,000 barrels a day, and that's declining at a rate of 6 to 9% a year. That's a problem for Alaska when 95% of our state revenues comes from oil. It's also a problem when we're no longer at $115, $120 a barrel, but we're at $100 a barrel of oil. So we've got not only declining production, but declining price. That means less state revenue. That means less services. It means less money available for hydro projects, for education, for public safety. And so my job really is to promote and grow economic opportunity in this state. And the only way I know, one way I know how to do that with the oil industry is to work to increase production. Let's not fight over whether we're going to turn out the lights at 100,000 barrels a day or 300,000 barrels a day. Let's figure out how to grow it to 1 million barrels a day. So that's the underpinning of oil tax policy, is growing economic pie for Alaskans.
A lot of people pointed out that the oil companies make record profits, and I know you get the question a lot, but yeah. But how do you square that, giving incentives to oil companies at the same time while they're making record profits?
Well, let me put it this way. I like Alaska businesses making profits, because that means you're going to hire more people and there's more money in our economy. The question isn't how much profit do they make. The question is, where do they spend those profits? If they're making profit in Alaska and spending it in North Dakota and Texas, I don't like that. I want to find a way to bring those profits back here. I'm not trying to make them less profitable. I'm trying to make them spend their profits here in Alaska and grow Alaska's economy. That's Econ 101, that in America, we actually do want companies to make a profit because they can hire more people and they can invest those dollars. I just want them invested in Alaska. That's what I'm trying to bring about.
So taking a look at the conversation that happened this year.
Let me tell you what's really dangerous about that discussion.
Yeah.
Let me take it the next step.
Sure.
Because, you know, everybody is righteous about hating an oil company. But we actually have a senator who thinks – not Sitka senator. I don't want to – because he and I work together really well. But we actually have a senator out there who thinks that, you know, 20% profit, that's kind of where government should regulate things. Well, in other words, government should not allow any company to make more than 20%. Well, does that mean that your local office supply store can't make more than 20% on its pencils? Does that mean a movie theater can't make more than 20% on its popcorn? Does that mean a fisherman cannot make more than 20%? I mean, really? Do we really want to say that? And if we say it about one company, what's to stop government from saying that about every company? So again, it's not about how much profit they make. It's whether they spend it here.
And you feel that the argument about regulating it is a slippery slope.
Absolutely. It clearly is, because that means government can get into everybody's business, and that's not something I want to see happen.
All right. Shift gears again. Education.
Okay.
I covered Sitka's school budget process this year. It was less painful than a lot of other communities around the state, but there was still some degree of hurt to it. And the question that came up there was, in a state that has a surplus, in a state where that's so much better off than many of the other states in the union, why is funding education still a struggle in so many communities?
Hmm. I kind of ask it the other way. Why? What is the public getting for the record increases in education spending in the last 4 years? That, I mean, I kind of flip it around. And really my question for the school districts this year when they came forward and said, we want an increased BSA, an increased base student allocation. What they're saying is we want you to automatically increase for the next 3 years this allocation to our school districts. Well, my job as governor is to make sure that Alaskans are getting what they're paying for and that they know what that they're getting what they're paying for so that their money is being well spent. It's my obligation to Alaskans to make sure their money is well spent. So I ask the question, what are we getting for these increases? You know, you could have heard the crickets in the background. It kind of made me – and also then I got blasted in the press for trying to cut education when that wasn't what I was doing. What I was doing was saying – I've proposed an increase to education. You want an even greater increase, and you want it to go in this formula. What are Alaskans getting for it? So where we ended up was we heard testimony, you know, school districts are facing increased utility costs. And we finally got the numbers on what that was. We funded that increase because I think that's holding a school district accountable and saying, utility costs went up? Okay, I get that. But write the check. Fuel costs went up, and they went up X amount of dollars. Okay, I get that. Let's write the check for that. And then in the end, there was an allocation across districts based upon student population. And so there effectively was a compromise between kind of those one-time funding. It was all one-time funding, but it was accountable funding to a greater degree than had we just said, just increase the BSA. And I think that's good. It's good for the public.
Obviously, increasing that per pupil funding, the BSA, would mean more resources for districts. But school districts like Sitka also argue that it would mean better planning, especially the bill that was on the table this year to do three years. And they said, you know, boy, that if we get that guarantee that these funds are going to be in place, the timeline looks a lot better. We can tell our teachers if they're coming back to work. We know what to do in the years ahead.
Well, listen, teachers should know they're coming back to work because we've also forward-funded education for the next year. And for a school district to say that they can plan better I guess if they were guaranteed they're guaranteed a certain level right now so they can plan better. They already are guaranteed K-12 funding formula for another year beyond this one. Guaranteed, no question. It's already there. It's in the bank. It's been allocated for it. So they can plan at least for the next 2 years. Now, I just think it makes better sense for the public to know what their money is being spent on. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish.
I want to ask you to respond to something our superintendent has said, not about you or your administration directly, but about the national conversation around education. Hmm. And he often, during conversations, especially about financial matters, starts talking about his feeling that education's under attack in this country and that those professionals who work in public education don't get the recognition or don't get the professional respect that they deserve, and that that the policy is all centered around the idea that teachers are just in it for more money and those kinds of things in the national. How do you feel the national conversation is about education? How do you feel the conversation is here in Alaska? Are we setting the right tone?
I bring it on home. My mom was a school teacher for 26 years, and I saw her put money out of her own pocket, you know, to put the posters up on the board and, you know, decorate her classroom. And I saw the nights she gave to grading papers, and I even helped her on a few of those nights, grade papers. I know from being a family member of a school teacher the sacrifices that teachers make, and I honor that and acknowledge that. I think here in Alaska we've made education a priority. But it's not just about writing a check. We've made writing a check a priority. That's why the education community here has seen record increases, like I've said, beyond anything they've ever seen in the state's history. I would pause it out there. At the same time, we've changed incentives for kids. And I think about the Alaska Performance Scholarship, for example. 3 years ago, I pursued this as a new way to incentivize more rigorous coursework for our kids. I said, look, if you're willing to take 4 years of math and 4 years of science and also put together a vocational training track in there as well, if you're willing to do that, we'll reward you. You've earned a scholarship, an Alaska Performance Scholarship. Did that 3 years ago. And then this year we put in place the funding mechanism for it. We put aside $400 million and said we'll live on the interest and earnings of that. We'll pay for these scholarships out of the interest and earnings of that account. ended up building in the needs-based scholarships as part of that too. But the bottom line is we make education a priority in this state. It's part of our constitutional priorities. And we are redesigning the incentives for kids in that education arena so that they can perform better. It's not, for me, it's not about just writing a bigger check in a system that doesn't always meet the needs that parents believe their kids have.
It seems like educationally, it seems like there's a lot of breadth to the Alaskan education system, from a big urban district like Anchorage to school districts in our listening area of 10 students, 12 students.
Yeah.
That's a lot to keep track of, and that's a lot to shape policy around.
It is, but we managed to do it as a state. I mean, I'll just give you an example. A couple of years back, the senator and representative from Southwest Alaska said, come see our dilapidated schools. And I went, and frankly, every time I go to a community, pretty much I either have seen or I do see that school or schools in the community. And I went, I kicked the tires on these schools and saw kids in class in some pretty bad conditions. You know, in one Southwest village, they were having to cut ice blocks from their sewage lagoon to make room for more sewage to go into their sewage lagoon. I saw kids in a classroom at about 90 degrees with the door open at, you know, 10 below zero outside because the heat wouldn't regulate in the classroom. Just conditions that you would not normally experience in a place like Sitka or surrounding communities. And I began, and I went to work with those representatives and legislators to create a funding system that was equitable for rural areas, along with the 70-30 match that we gave for school construction in the more urban areas. Did that. We finished that legislation 2 years ago, I believe. In the past year, we had a longstanding piece of litigation named Kasaili over the inequities of rural school construction. We resolved that. We resolved the Moore litigation, which was over inequities in the delivery of education services to kids in some rural areas of our state. It is a vast state when it comes to policy and differences, but at bottom, we just want our kids to be educated so they can take a place in our workforce and be prepared for life. And that's going to take homework at home, and it's going to take schoolwork at school.
You were the Chamber of Commerce speaker today on the Wednesday that we're recording this. A week ago, it was Senator Stedman, and at the end of his speech, somebody asked him, how are you going to fix Sitka's roads? And he said, many things that he said, but among them was, next week when the governor's here, somebody should take him for a ride out our highways and see what he thinks. Did you go for that ride?
I have not gone for that ride, but I certainly have been warned about the washboards, and Senator Stedman was good about ticking off a list of the road projects we're going to get done this year and next here in Sitka, and several of those problem child streets were listed and named by him.
But it's interesting that Alaska is a young enough state that a lot of our infrastructure is starting to degrade for the first time, and so there's no mechanism set up in a community like Sitka for sinking funds or for any of those kinds of resources that a lot of other places rely on. Is that a problem you're seeing across the state?
It is, and that's one of the problems I tackled when I first came into office. Is we never really set aside money for deferred maintenance. You know, there's some ongoing maintenance that gets done, but we also have a backlog of deferred maintenance. And so I set a plan. I said for 5 years, we're going to devote $100 million to deferred maintenance of our roads, our university buildings and infrastructure, and our public facilities, and have kept true to that promise. And while it's not going to solve the backlog, it is the first time that we've had a consistent deferred maintenance program in the state, and DOT gets quite a chunk of that $100 million in addition to their budgeted funds for maintenance. So it's a never-ending obligation.
Here in Sitka, on the outer shore of Kruzoff Island, folks who've been out there boating and camping and hiking have started to notice tsunami debris washing up. I know that that's happening elsewhere in Alaska, too. So your administration planning any kind of response to what could be an environmental situation, if not a crisis, on our shoreline?
We already are, and we recognize that the debris can be a hazard. And I guess the first priority was to make sure it was not and would not be a human hazard, and then secondly, the environmental hazard as well. And I've been in touch multiple times with our DEC commissioner, Larry Hartig, to assure that we are making sure that Alaskans will not be personally harmed, physically harmed by it. I've received assurances from him that based on what he's hearing from the federal government, that that's the case. When it comes to actual cleanup, which is has to do with environmental degradation, that is something as well that we believe is the federal government's responsibility that we're working to coordinate with them. And I think it's going to be important to rely on local knowledge of what's happening and where, and rely on local people to be a part of that cleanup effort. So I've asked Commissioner Hartig to work with the federal government and figure that out, figure out how we can do that. I would urge your listeners to contact the commissioner's office in Juneau if they have some ideas on that. Commissioner Larry Hartig, Department of Environmental Conservation. That's a topic that I raise with him about every 2 weeks, just to say, where is this stuff? What's happening? And so far, I've been assured that we have not been hit to a large degree yet. But if anybody sees something different, please let us know.
All right. You're 2 years into your first full term as governor.
Almost 3 years total now.
Best part of the job, worst part of the job?
Best part of the job is just is being able to be effective for individual people in this state and create opportunity for them. What was the second question?
The worst part of the job.
Worst part of the job. You know, I love being able to do what I do for Alaskans, and I would not want to be anywhere else than where I am. So no complaints, you know, at this point. I just I hope that Alaskans can tell when I speak with them, when I listen to them, I hope they can see my love for Alaska and my love for Alaskans as a people, my desire to see us all have a better life together. So that's kind of what I think will be my lasting legacy.
Just before you came up the stairs here at Raven Radio, I know we're almost out of time, but I mentioned, you know, okay, the governor's going to be here shortly, just so you know. And Judy, next door, who's hosting the folk music show, wondered out loud, what kind of music does he listen to? So what's in your iPod, Governor?
You know, I love anything with a raspy vocal, an electric guitar behind it.
Yeah? So, like who are we talking about?
I listen to everything from rock to country to alternative to contemporary Christian music. I mean, it just spans the gamut. All so right. Like I said, so who should we think of? You know, if it's a day like this, what would you be listening to?
Something upbeat, I would say.
Something upbeat?
Yeah.
Yeah. But like I said, anything with a raspy vocal and electric guitars. So my wife is a little more, she likes more acoustic guitar.
Your tastes sound as eclectic as our programming schedule.
Well, I did notice your LPs in the,
yeah.
I love seeing the vinyl in there, and that's fantastic.
We'll go out and take a look in a second.
Okay.
Governor Sean Parnell, thank you for your time.
Thank you.